mild. The president didn't say, don't shoot them. The president welcomed the comment. Everything about the president's reaction to one of his voters saying, shoot them, indicated that the president approved of the idea. The president actually offered his audience the strategic advice to not try to get away with saying, shoot them, unless they're in a place like the Florida panhandle.
How do you stop these people? You can't. There's no... That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement. Only in the panhandle.
Yeah, but here is the thing about that. It is not only in the panhandle where you can get away with that statement. You can now get away with it all over the country. And, as he just made painfully clear, in any room the actual president is in, which is absolutely appalling. And that is something we cannot afford to get numb to. Because if that ever, for even a moment, feels like it's become normal, we are completely f***ed.
Is there anything in your mind that the president can do now to make this any better?
What do you think? You know the shit he's been saying. He's been calling Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals. I don't know, like, members of the press, what the fuck? Hold on a second. You know, it's these questions that you know the answers to. I mean, connect the dots about what he's been doing in this country. He's not tolerating racism, he is promoting racism. He's not tolerating violence, he's inciting racism and violence in this country.
Yes, we've had a rise in hate crimes, every single one of the last 3 years, during an administration where you have a president who's called Mexicans rapists and criminals, though Mexican immigrants commit crimes at a far lower rate than those born here in the country, he has tried to make us afraid of them to some real effect and consequence. Attempting to ban all Muslims from this country, the day that he signed that executive order, the mosque in Victoria, Texas, was burned to the ground. Those chants that we heard in Greenville, North Carolina, send her back, talking about our fellow American citizens duly elected to represent their constituents in the Congress, who happen to be women of color. He is a racist, and he stokes racism in this country, and it does not just offend our sensibilities, it fundamentally changes the character of this country, and it leads to violence.
I'm gonna kill you with this one bullet if you try to take his gun. So, come on, take it. If you can.
Hand it over. You'll be dead before you can draw the hammer back.
That's so.
We know there is a clear correlation between the number of guns we have in this country and the number of gun-related deaths we have in this country. For one thing, America has 4.4% of the world's population, but almost half of its civilian-owned guns. There are proven, straightforward, widely popular ways that we can at least begin to address this epidemic of gun violence. And then, of course, there's the issue of the president's racist, anti-immigrant rhetoric and the growing threat of white supremacy. Our political leaders should have to answer for where they stand on these issues. And yet, at first, some senior Republicans refused to even go on TV and answer questions about it. CNN's Jake Tapper noted on his show on Sunday morning.
We're going to talk with at least four presidential candidates today about what they would do to stop this epidemic of mass shootings and shootings. We should note that we invited the Republican governor, lieutenant governor, and both Republican U.S. senators representing Texas to join us this morning. They all declined. The Republican governor of Ohio also declined. We also asked the White House to provide someone to discuss these shootings. That request, too, was declined.
Republican members of Congress refused to go on CNN to talk about the shootings. Now, the cops in Dayton ran into the line of fire to stop the guy shooting. The politicians were too cowardly to go on cable television to talk about it. And meanwhile, this is what our president was busy with this weekend. This is not a joke. ASAP Rocky, released from prison and on his way home to the United States from Sweden. It was a rocky week. Get home ASAP, ASAP. Good one, Mr. President. You got that dollar sign in just the right spot. But back to the shootings in El Paso and Dayton.
We're talking to a lot of people. And a lot of things are in the works and a lot of good things. And we have done much more than most administrations. And it's not talked about very much, but we've done actually a lot. But perhaps more has to be done.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, do more. That would be good, because whatever you've been doing doesn't seem to be going too great. He refuses to take any responsibility for any of this, but he did take the opportunity to point that little finger of blame at, you'll never guess who. The media has a big responsibility to life and safety in our country. Fake news has contributed greatly to the anger and rage that has built up over many years. News coverage has got to start being fair, balanced, and unbiased, or these terrible problems will only get worse. He blamed the fake news, and later he and some other Republicans blamed video games. And of course, there are zero studies that link video games to gun violence. And they play video games all over the world. This is the only place where this happens regularly. Video games have not been linked to gun violence, but you know what is linked to gun violence? Guns are linked to gun violence. That, the problem isn't fake news. It's real guns. Anyway, the president today tried his very best to be presidential. They even fired up the old teleprompter so Trump could finally come out against white supremacy and offer words of condolence to the people of Dayton, Ohio, which he calls Toledo.
May God bless the memory of those who perished in Toledo.
Yeah, nobody perished in Toledo. It was Dayton. They're different cities. And by the way, the word Toledo, if you'll see here, wasn't even in the teleprompter. Someone got this shot, and it clearly says Texas and Ohio. So nice work, Don Burgundy. You're doing great. And this really tells, this, I think maybe more than anything, gives you some insight into how much this man cares. 14 minutes after he tweeted about the shooting in El Paso on Saturday, he followed it up with a shout out to you, UFC fighter. Fight hard tonight, Colby. You are a real champ. Hashtag MAGA. And like many Americans who've been repeatedly punched in the head, Colby Covington is a big Donald Trump supporter. And there's nothing Donald Trump loves more than people who love Donald Trump.
Count to three.
All the way up to six if I had to. Maybe faster than you.
One.
When I say three, draw. One.
If you say two, I'll kiss the
count. Two.
Gee, I'll kill the next man who speaks.
Gosh, what excitement.
In his own way, Trump tried to heal a nation.
Now is the time to set destructive partisanship aside, so destructive, and find the courage to answer hatred with unity, devotion, and love.
Yes, we must set aside partisan bickering over who fired up the white nationalists in our country and come together as one to sing, "Send her back, oh Lord, send her back. Someone's different, Lord, send her back. I'm not racist, Lord."
They like my jokes. We listen to all my little ones.
Trump defended guns on camera, but on Twitter he was more open to compromise.
Republicans and Democrats must come together and get strong background checks, perhaps marrying dot, 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 this legislation with desperately needed immigration reform. We must have something good, if not great, come out of these two tragic events. And if I know anything about marrying, it's always a tragic event.
But listen to what he's doing. Listen. Listen to what he's trying to do. Listen to what he's trying to do here. Gun control and immigration reform have nothing to do with each other, and they're also the two hardest things to do in Washington, so naturally, he just wants to combine them.
Congress has not been able to eat fire or levitate. So they should try to do them both at the same time. Might make it easier to levitate with those flames shooting out your butt.
And sure enough, when Trump did read off the teleprompter today, he ticked through the usual scapegoats he has in the past, mental illness, video games, and did it flatly.
In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. We must reform our mental health laws to better identify mentally disturbed individuals who may commit acts of violence and make sure those people not only get treatment, but when necessary, involuntary confinement. Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun.
First of all, he's wrong. Second, he sounds like a fourth grader auditioning for the role of the Scarecrow in Wizard of Oz.
I would like a line. Brian.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain,
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. I'd unravel every riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain.
With the thoughts you'd be thinking, you could be another Lincoln if you only had a brain.
Oh, I could tell you why the ocean's near the shore. I could think of things I never thought before, and then I'd sit and think some more. I would not be just a nuffin, my head all full of stuffin', my heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry, life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
It's an invasion of our country. We have an invasion of drugs, invasion of gangs, invasion of people.
I don't care what the fake media says, that's an invasion of our country.
We have right now an invasion. If you look at what's going on with the caravans, it's an invasion. Stop this onslaught, this invasion into our country, Jim. People hate the word invasion, but that's what it is.
The New York Times reports that since January, Mr. Trump's re-election campaign has posted more than 2,000 ads on Facebook that include the word invasion, part of a barrage of advertising focused on immigration. According to data obtained by the New York Times, the Trump campaign had one of its biggest expenditures on Facebook ads about immigration last week, just before the El Paso massacre.
You know, the way terrorism works, there are a lot of angry people. There are a lot of ideologically motivated people out there. But it takes a piling on of grievance, an exacerbation of grievance, and also a dehumanization of the enemy in order to take somebody who's angry and politicized and have them mobilize and cross that threshold to violence. And I think that's what we've seen, especially in the last couple months, with this, beating the drum on this whole issue of invasion, but also the comments about the four members of Congress of color and the rats and the vermin. All of those things are, you know, part and parcel of what brings somebody from just being a highly politicized ideological person to a violent person.
And you make the point in your essay about the language of the mass murder in Pittsburgh at the synagogue, the language of the mass murder in El Paso, being Trump language, this desperate fear they have about what they call this invasion at the southern border.
It's the whole series of these grievances that triggers these very deep emotions in people. They say that the immigrants are going to harm them economically. He says they're going to take away their security, that they're all criminals, rapists. And then he talks about, they're coming into the country. They're gonna vote me out of office. They're going to do all these things to me, and you're going to be under a different rule. You're going to be under minority rule. So they're taking away their political power. So he piles on one set of grievance after the other. And, this is what highly ideological terrorist organizations do to motivate their followers to violence.
And you make the point that how much more of this kind of violence might we see in the next 15 months of the presidential campaign? And you say if the president continues with this kind of rhetoric, it's hard to imagine the president using any other kind of rhetoric. This is what he's been using since the day he announced his candidacy.
Well, you're right about that. I mean, I would certainly plead to him to turn back. You know, he announced his campaign, started his campaign in July, and here we are in August, and this has happened. I just don't think the country can take 15 months of that kind of heightened, highly politicized, highly racialized rhetoric.
I would send out for assistance, but the soul on the signal wire and the corporation logo is flashing on and off in the sky. They're putting all your names in the forbidden book. I know what they're doing, but I don't want to look. You think they're so dumb, you think they're so funny. Wait until they got you running.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
You are listening to 90.7 FM WGXC, the local hangout of the airwaves in Greene and Columbia counties.
This is 2019 new music from local band Wet Spell, which is Pat Lennon and Andrew Weathers. And the EP is called Littlefield. This song is called Miami.
While you are sunning yourself, I'll be wearing extra clothes, and I'll call down to Miami to let you know how it goes when I kick the tires, pop the hood. I'll have the money in my pocket if it all seems good. And when they call from Los Cerritos, tell them I'll meet them at the mall. If I ain't home when you get their check, the cupboard in the hall.
Thank you.
This is Aaron Pednati, and I'm talking to you from the Rally to Shut Down Detention Centers in Glens Falls, New York. And I'm talking to world-renowned author, activist, and founder of 350.org, Bill McKibben. Bill, thanks so much for this interview. It's great to be talking to you. I wanted to ask why you came here today.
Well, I mean, of course, all Americans who stop to think about it are saddened and really heartbroken by what's going on down the border. But those of us who work on climate issues may have our own special reasons. The climate crisis and the immigration crisis overlap in very profound ways. We know from great reporting in the Times and elsewhere that hundreds of thousands of people have had to flee the highlands of Guatemala and El Salvador because they've had an unprecedented drought, precisely the kind of thing that scientists tell us will happen as the planet warms. In fact, the UN estimates that we can expect between 200 million and a billion climate refugees in the course of this century. So we better start figuring out something to do other than building a wall and tossing people in cages. It's time for us to recognize that people are having to leave through no fault of their own. They're coming from places that didn't pour carbon into the atmosphere like we did. And we better figure out how to make sure that we have some kind of working way to welcome people.
There's a cover story on the New York Times today about the threat to the global food supply that climate change poses. And it says that hundreds of millions of people might lose access to food in the very near future if we don't do something. And if that goes down, we're going to be seeing a lot more global turbulence in terms of migrations and the type of anti-immigrant energy that we're seeing in the U.S. right now is alarming in that regard. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess the good news is we're seeing a lot of pro-immigrant energy, too. People really pouring out to try and stop the travel ban, try and close down these camps. It's one of the things that the Democratic candidates in this year's election have been outspoken and strong about. So I guess we're going to see. It's going to be a real test of our character as a country, one of the issues that will obviously decide the next election. But as I say, it's likely to get more intense as the century wears on. You know, there's not walls high enough to keep hungry people from trying to feed their families.
So at the event we were just at, we just walked over to Elise Stefanik's office and were protesting and demanding action on detention centers. And there's a group of Trump supporters out there that were chanting hateful slogans. They had a megaphone with a siren attached to it that was blaring in our faces. And there was a feeling of almost incipient fascism. And in the face of the chaos that we're potentially facing as a civilization, there's a growing anxiety, particularly on the left, that that type of energy might become much more salient and a powerful influence on society in the very near future if the types of disruptions that climate change could bring about go unchecked. What do you think about that tendency, sort of looking into those faces? And
I think that one of the great gifts of the 20th century was nonviolent social movements. I think they're extraordinarily powerful. I think we've barely begun to sense their power. And that's what I spend my life building, places like 350.org and things. And so I think we need to double down. Nonviolence is a tool of enormous power, but it requires lots of people using it.
So what's your sense of the future? Do you think it's possible to be hopeful? Are you cautiously hopeful? Are you dire and dystopian? How are you feeling about things right now?
I'm never good at figuring out what's going to happen in the long run. I don't spend a lot of time being optimistic or pessimistic. Just get up in the morning and go to work and see what we can do. And I mean, there's obviously movements building strongly. Obviously, the science around things like climate change is very hard, and that's driving a lot of what we see in terms of things like immigration. So those things are all hard truths. We'll see if we can catch up with it. It's going to take everyone moving fast. And one of the next actual moments for everyone to do this is September 20th, when Greta Thunberg has asked and her young colleagues have asked adults to join the climate strikes that they've been running for over a year now. So September 20th is a day of all ages climate strikes around the world. It'll probably be the biggest day of climate action ever. So that'll be good.
Okay, and one last question is, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, for which I am interviewing you, is a Capital Region-based news radio show. Mm-hmm. So for Capital Region folks, what sort of recommendations do you have about locally-based climate activism, the most pressing issues in this region right now?
Well, I mean, the truth is, there's lots of people doing good work at local levels, and that's really important. Almost every town now has some kind of climate action committee. There's 350 groups up and down the Hudson, so on and so forth. It's really important to be working there, but it's also really important. I mean, they don't call it global warming for nothing. So some of the time we need to come together globally and really put pressure on those institutions that can write the rules at a level high enough to make a difference.
So your sense of it is that we ought to be thinking globally more than locally?
I think we ought to be thinking both. Think globally, act globally, think locally, act locally. Just get in the game.
Do everything you can.
There you are.
All right. Well, thanks very much,
Thank
Bill.
You. Thank you very much, Adam.
WGXC 90.7 FM. Acre Hudson, listener-supported radio in Greene and Columbia counties.
Lithuanian composer Martin Rock engineers the collision of ambient noise and cinematic forces in his music, and we'll venture into deep space with him on the next Deep Threes. Plus, music from Christina Pato, V.J. Iyer, William Onyebor, and Nina Cherry. Deep Threes. Where will the music take you?
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marilyn R. Prof. of Holiday, Florida. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Trump's America, gun violence and the war on immigrants. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The country was rocked by two mass killings this past weekend. The first was in El Paso, Texas. The slaughter of 22 people in El Paso's Cielo Fiesta Walmart was an act of a white supremacist. A manifesto he allegedly posted online shortly before the massacre echoed President Donald Trump's anti-immigrant, anti-Latino rhetoric. This attack is a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas, the alleged shooter wrote. Late that night in Dayton, Ohio, throngs of people were enjoying the Oregon Entertainment District when another white man in his 20s opened fire, killing 9 people in about 30 seconds before police killed him. Among those he murdered was his sibling. Unlike the El Paso killer, the Dayton shooter left no manifesto to explain his motivation for the rampage, but had in the past expressed violent fantasies and obsession with mass shootings, and classmates said he kept a rape and kill list while in high school. Misogyny is so often linked to mass killers. These horrific attacks have spurred political momentum for a change in the broken gun laws that have for far too long made the United States a virtual free fire zone. President Trump read a speech from a teleprompter Monday, rambling on about mental health and violent video games, largely towing the NRA line. While he did suggest support for a national red flag law, allowing court-ordered confiscation of guns from a person deemed a threat to others or to him or herself, Trump said,
"Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun."
In fact, people who suffer from mental illness are far more likely to be the victims of gun violence than perpetrators of it. He also called for the death penalty for mass shooters. While the Dayton shooter is dead, the El Paso shooter turned himself in to a police officer not far from the scene of the crime. His online declaration began, "I support the Christchurch shooter and his manifesto," unquote. In fact, how New Zealand's elected leader and society at large responded to that massacre last March of 51 Muslims should be the model for what happens in the United States. New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, is the world's youngest elected leader. After the Christchurch massacre, committed by a single gunman armed with an arsenal of legally purchased semi-automatic weapons, Ardern immediately pushed a ban on all semi-automatic and military-style weapons through Parliament.
50 people died and they do not have a voice. We in this House are their voice,
the Prime Minister said. In less than a month after the massacre, the assault weapons ban became law in New Zealand. Trump did call Ardern to express condolences. Ardern said of the call,
"He asked what offer of support the United States could provide. My message was sympathy and love for all Muslim communities."
When addressing her nation in response to the massacre, Ardern said,
"Many of those who will have been directly affected by this shooting may be migrants to New Zealand. They may even be refugees here. They have chosen to make New Zealand their home, and it is their home. They are us. The person who has perpetuated this violence against us is not. They have no place in New Zealand."
Before departing from the White House to visit survivors in Dayton and El Paso Wednesday, Trump refused to take back his use of the word invasion, which he's repeatedly used to describe the arrival of immigrants and asylum seekers at the southern border. According to Media Matters for America, quote, between January and February, President Donald Trump's Facebook page ran about 2,200 ads referring to immigration as an invasion, unquote. His use of the word invasion was invoked as justification by the killers in El Paso, in Christchurch, and in Pittsburgh last year. There, the shooter entered a synagogue and gunned down 11 Jewish worshipers who he believes supported, quote, invaders. The response in New Zealand was to ban assault and semi-automatic weapons and to embrace diverse immigrant communities. In the United States under Trump, the opposite is happening. Next month, laws will take effect in Texas, loosening gun restrictions, for example, forbidding the banning of guns in schools and churches. Then on Wednesday, the day Trump was ostensibly consoling wounded survivors in Dayton and El Paso, Immigration and Customs Enforcement conducted the largest single-state workplace enforcement action ever, arresting 680 people at several Mississippi food processing plants, accusing them of being undocumented. The scourge of guns and the war on immigrants continue. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC, hands-on, listener-supported radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
Next, WOOC's Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Chris Caulfield, a researcher on the opioid crisis at RPI.
Okay, we're back with Chris Caulfield, who was a PhD student at RPI studying the opioid polydrug crisis. We've already gotten into some of the barriers to access, the class, race, and gender problems that are contributing to this crisis. So, Chris, what is the aim of your research?
My research aims to improve public health outcomes around drug treatment services. So I interview clinicians and other professionals about how stigma and shame enter into clinical care, or through insurance regulations, or through legal affairs. So my work examines how social and cultural factors impact health outcomes in drug treatment.
And how does stigma create a barrier to access?
Good question. So stigma can be viewed as a socially produced relational relation where a person who is stigmatized is marked out as being somehow deficient or worthy of public shame or somehow pushed away from the community. And stigma has been one of the tough nuts of drug treatment for decades. It's often been said that shame kills, stigma kills, silence kills. If a person feels ashamed of his or her or their drug use, then that person may very well hide that use from everyone, from family, from friends, and from their practitioner. And so if the people around them don't know about the use, that can make addressing the use, obviously, way tougher.
Let's talk about your methodology. How do you even go about measuring the extent to which stigma prevents people from seeking services?
Good question. So my methodology is unstructured or semi-structured qualitative interviews. So I'm interviewing clinicians, I'm interviewing public health researchers, law enforcement, policymakers, and I'm talking with them about how their personal experiences, how have they seen stigma enter into the interactions between patients and people who need care. And so I'm not measuring things quantitatively. I'm trying to get stories. in order to kind of round out the quantitative work that's already being done very well by many. So yeah, that's it.
What do they say? What are some of the anecdotes that you've gotten?
So the anecdotes run the gamut. I mean, some of the anecdotes, some of the clinicians that I have interviewed have told me stories about other clinicians who described patients in language that is definitely stigmatizing. For example, one psychiatrist works at a major urban hospital, and she works in a unit that treats women who are pregnant and postpartum and seeking and have a use issue, substance use disorder. So she told me a story about OBGYN, obstetrics gynecology physician, who she was working with on a patient. And so my informant told me that the OBGYN was talking about this patient, and the informant said, "Well, I want to thank you for your good work because this patient is doing well. She's come a long way." And the OBGYN looked at her with kind of disgust, and she said, "But she wouldn't let me tie her tubes," as in her fallopian tubes, as in for permanent or semi-permanent contraceptive. So this is the kind of way that stigma is talked about by some clinicians. The decision to tie one's fallopian tubes is obviously a major life decision. And so this OBGYN was really expressing a patronizing, paternalistic view that is unethical from a clinician's standpoint. It's not in conformity with patient autonomy, with respect for patient autonomy. It's the woman's decision whether or not she wants to tie her tubes. Another clinician told me that on one of her days in the job, she overheard a senior level provider who referred to a patient as an asshole junkie on the phone, to probably a private conversation. I interviewed a police officer who also related that many of his colleagues, fellow police officers, refer to patients in a deeply stigmatizing way, like a junkie, a drug abuser. So those are some of the ways that stigmatized attitudes are expressed, or that they're noticed by my informants.
So obviously language is very important to this stigma problem. What are some ways that we can talk about substance use disorders without stigmatizing people?
Good question. So you just mentioned one in your question. Instead of talking about addiction, which I've been using because it's part of the nomenclature, we can talk about substance use disorder, or better yet, perhaps, chaotic use. So the words that we use are important. So I mentioned already drug abuse. Well, abuse is carries a certain connotation of oftentimes associated with violence. And so using that word drug abuse can subtly change the tenor of the conversation. And so refraining from using that kind of language can help us, I think, and I'm not alone in saying this, can help us to develop ways of relating to drug users that are more compassionate.
Do you find that class, race, and gender stigmas are compounding with this problem, given that treatment tends to be gendered, tends to have a race factor?
Absolutely. So going back to the issue of women who use drugs while pregnant or postpartum. In 25 states, if memory serves me, there are laws on the books that criminalize a woman who tests positive for drugs upon giving birth, illicit drugs. And what does that do? That does several things. It drives those women to not tell their providers that they're using drugs, and so the providers can't possibly provide those women with substance use disorder treatment while they're pregnant or postpartum. It drives women to, in some cases, refuse to even tell providers that they're pregnant because they don't want, if they're picked up on a drug charge, because they don't want to face increased incarceration or perhaps separation from their forthcoming child. It also pushes women who are postpartum to refuse to disclose their drug use to clinicians because they, again, don't want to face incarceration. Of course they don't. So the postpartum period is one of the deadliest periods for drug users because after they've given birth, in many cases, they stop use during pregnancy. And then after birth, postpartum period, lots of stressors, they may begin using again, but their tolerance has reduced because they haven't been using. So the drug becomes much more deadly. For example, opioids or heroin. So the postpartum period is an extremely difficult and potentially deadly period for these women, and they need help, not incarceration. So that's one way that gender intersects with addiction treatment.
So this has been part two of our interview with Chris Caulfield, and we're going to come back with part three next time. For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
Rise up now. Our friend Gaston says we're made of lines. Lines made from the pure movement of time.
Next is PC Worship, their new album Social Rust. This is the song Odd from PC Worship.